last week we covered the rise of New Deal, the New Deal and New Deal federalism, the social insurance model embodied in the Social Security program, and the welfare model embodied in the Cash Assistance Aid to Families with Dependent Children program. We then talked about the evolution of Medicare and Medicaid, tracing our way from Harry Truman on through to Lyndon Johnson, on through to Wilbur Mills, and the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. We then talked about the early years of Medicaid, the first era of Medicaid, really the first 20 years or so, mid-60s to mid-80s, which I called the era of state discretion and interstate variation. And then we then talked about the second era of Medicaid, which was really in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when the federal government imposed significant new eligibility mandates, reimbursement mandates, benefit mandates, Medicaid costs skyrocketed, and tension between the states and the federal government increased significantly. So that's what we did last week. The goal this week is to finish our discussion of the Medicaid program and to talk about the Medicare program. And with Medicare, what I'm going to be doing is talking about Medicare from its enactment in 1965, really on through to December of 1993, when the Medicare Modernization Act was passed, the Medicare drug law was passed that has recently gone into effect, that I'm sure you've all been reading about in the newspapers and hearing about on television. We're not going to go into depth on the Medicare drug bill today, but hopefully we'll get right up to the point when that bill was enacted. Next week, and at the end of this class, if we get there, although certainly next week, we're going to talk about the uninsured. We're going to shift gears and talk about the uninsured next week. Then we don't have class on February the 20th because of President's Day. And when we come back on February the 27th, we're going to both talk about the Medicare drug law, the Medicare Modernization Act, and we're also going to break up into, I'll say, small groups, but since there's, I think, 230 students in the class, it'll probably either be 10 groups of 23 students or 12 groups of whatever it is, 18, 19 students. I haven't finalized that yet. In terms of the written assignment, the first written assignment that will be due on February 27th, I'm going to be sending something to the whole class in a couple of days on that this week. Let me just tell you very quickly what sort of the outline of the assignment's going to look like, just to give you a sense of it. And it's going to tie into what we're doing in the groups. What I'm going to be doing is dividing, again, you guys up into either 10 or 12 groups. Each group is going to, in effect, represent a different perspective in the debate over the uninsured. So there'll be, you know, there'll be a group representing big business, there'll be a group representing small business, there'll be a group representing sort of advocates of the uninsured, there'll be a group representing the states, you know, a group representing President Bush, a group representing the Democrats, a group representing, you know, the insurance industry, and so forth. The assignment, the written assignment that you're going to have is to write a memo from the perspective of the group to which you're assigned. So if you end up being assigned to an insurance company group or to a group of advocates for the uninsured or to a group of big business community folks, you're going to be writing a memo about the perspective of that group on the uninsured. So you can't really write the memo till the group assignments are made and until I give you a sense of what I want in the memo. And also, I don't think, you can certainly start thinking about the memo before next week's class, but next week we're going to be going over in-depth options around the uninsured, and it's really building off of what we do in class next week and the readings on the uninsured that you'll then have to think about from your perspective of your particular group, what you think you know, your organization ought to be advocating sort of in the political sphere. We'll then collect all of those memos the beginning of class on the 27th, and you'll then go to the breakout groups in which there'll be 20 other people in the class there with you or in the group with you, all of whom wrote on a similar topic, all of whom also wrote on, you know, the uninsured from the perspective of big business or the perspective of George Bush or whoever. And you'll have a discussion among yourself, and again, you'll hopefully be fairly informed about it because you've just written a four or five, six page memo on it. And then we'll come back to the class and report on what happened in the groups. So, and I will send you, as I said, probably by Wednesday or Thursday of this week, an email, or I'll put it up on Courseworks one way or the other, basically both separating you out into groups, letting you know what group, and the groups are going to be divided up purely by alphabetical order. So if your name happens to begin with double A, or your name happens to begin with double Z, you know already what group you're in, either the first or the last. Everybody else, it'll just depend on how the numbers play out. So that's going to be the assignment. As I said, I'll get it to you in a couple of days, leading up to the breakout sessions on the 27th. Yeah.
Maybe this is intuitive, but can you describe the difference between an essay or whatever and a memo?
Yeah, I will in the guidelines that I give you, I'll be laying out what I want in the memo.
Okay.
I'll actually be giving you sort of a format that I want you to follow. Okay. Any other questions? Again, I don't know how many are taking advantage of it or if you even want to take advantage of it, but to the extent you want to hear anything that happened in the first couple of classes, those classes are actually available now sort of online, and the link is up on Courseworks right now to get the podcast or whatever it's called of the first couple of classes, and similarly the it'll be up for the rest of the classes so long as I continue to hit on and off at the right time during the lecture. Yeah.
Best preparation for this memo is taking good notes in class.
Yeah, I mean the memo is basically just going to be sort of building off the class, the readings, and the guidelines that I give you, and there'll be, I think there's three memos over the course of the semester. Along with one longer paper. Okie doke. Anything else before we get started? Okay, last week where I ended was talking about how the rising Medicaid costs in the late 1980s and early 1990s were generating significant intergovernmental tension, because from the state's point of view, it was these new federal mandates that were causing the problem. From the state's point of view, the federal government had imposed all these mandates, which had meant that the program had gone from one with about 20 million enrollees to one with about 40 million enrollees over just a few year period. Reimbursement had been increased via these mandates. The benefit package had been increased versus via these mandates. And so people on Medicaid were costing more money. There were more people on Medicaid. The states have to pay part of the bill. The states were in the midst of a recession. The economy was bad, and there was a lot of intergovernmental tension. That's where we ended last week. Yeah? The question was, for those who couldn't hear, didn't the federal government understand that it was going to be difficult, both politically and economically, for the states once these mandates were imposed? And I suppose the simple answer is sure. They understood that the states were being required to pay anywhere from 25 to 50% of the cost of these mandates. But I think the advocates for the mandates, Henry Waxman and others who were pushing the mandates, their goal was national health insurance. And their goal was, and they saw these eligibility expansions as sort of a backdoor way to get closer to national health insurance during an era when Ronald Reagan and then George Bush were president, and that this was something government ought to pay for. And so I don't think the fact that these mandates were going to cost money, particularly because I think they also said to themselves, the federal government's going to be paying between 50 and 80% of the bill of these mandates. So it's not as if the federal government is simply imposing a mandate and not paying for any of the cost of it themselves. But you're right. I mean, the federal government, by imposing mandates, does impose additional costs on states who have no choice but to pay. So the first thing, or one of the things that the states tried to do in response to the mandates, and this begins sort of a 15-year history of back and forth between the states and the federal government that gets very tricky. We're going to be talking about this later today as well. But the the states, beginning with the state of West Virginia and the state of Tennessee, figure out a way to get the federal government to pay more of the Medicaid bill. And here's what the states figure out. Say you have a state like New York, in which 50% of the Medicaid bill is paid for by the federal government and 50% by the states. I mean, the states then bill the counties for some of that, but say it's 50-50. And say you pay a hospital $100 under the Medicaid program. The hospital treats somebody in the Medicaid program, the bill is $100, the hospital submits the bill to Medicaid, Medicaid pays $100, the federal government pays $50, and the state pays $50. That's the way it presumably should work. Now say the hospitals are saying, we want more money. We want more greater reimbursement. And the state says, sorry, we don't have any more money. We can't pay you any more money. You know, times are tough. There's a recession going on. And the hospital says, well, you know, under these mandates, you've got to give us increased reimbursement. The feds have required it. And the state says, geez, I don't know what we're going to do. We just can't afford it. Well, in a couple of states, starting, as I said, with West Virginia and Tennessee, and then spreading like wildfire, the hospital associations and the nursing home associations and the states figure out a mechanism under which the hospitals can get more money, but the federal government will pay 100% of the cost increase. And here's what they do. Take that case I just gave you, in which there was a bill submitted for $100, 50 paid for by the feds, 50 paid for by the states. Now say the state says to the hospitals, all right, we're going to raise your reimbursement. We're going to give you an increase in Medicaid dollars to $110. So instead of getting $100, now you're going to get $110. So the federal government pays $55, and we, the state, pay $55. Except we also agree in advance to impose a tax on you, the hospitals in New York State, a state tax of $5. And so Medicaid pays the hospital $110, but then the hospital pays the state $5 under this special state tax. So now, what's the real reimbursement rate for that hospital? $105. Only who's now paying that $105? Well, the federal government is paying $55, and the states are paying $50. So what's basically happened is the states have given the hospitals a $5 rate increase financed 100% by the federal government. So all of a sudden, so this kind of gets discovered one day. Richard Dorman, who's George Bush Sr.'s budget director, is trying to figure out why the Medicaid costs are rising so rapidly in a couple of states, and it just doesn't seem to make sense to him. And finally he figures out that in West Virginia and Tennessee and then other states, they were engaging in these activities. And when you think about it, and we'll get to some other examples of this, you don't have to stop there if you're the state. Why can't you, you know, raise the, if you're paying the hospital $100 and so it's 50-50, why not raise the reimbursement to $200? So now the feds are paying $100 and the state's paying $100, right? And then impose a tax of, say, $80 on the hospitals. So now the hospital's real reimbursement rate is $120, right? Except that $120 is being paid for $100 by the feds and $20 by the state. So the hospital's actually gotten a $20 increase. They've gone from 100 to 120. The states have actually saved $30. They were paying 50, remember, Only now they're just paying 20. But of course the federal government is paying a lot more. They're paying 100 when they were only paying 50 before. They're paying 100 out of the real $120 rate reimbursement. So you can see how the opportunity to use sort of the joint federalism financing scheme presented the states with the ability to really impose, you know, a greater share of the cost on the federal government than was otherwise allowed by law. So states start doing this. They not only impose provider taxes on hospitals and nursing homes, but they also create what are known as voluntary donation programs, in which they raise reimbursement to hospitals, say, and then the hospitals just make a voluntary donation or a gift to the state treasury. So the feds get very upset about this as well. And the feds go to Congress and say, we have to stop this. You know, this is fraud. This is illegal. This is inappropriate. This is states, you know, accounting gimmickry, you know, shifting more and more of the cost of the Medicaid program to us, the state. But of course, Congress isn't too anxious to stop this, because what happens in Congress? Well, the governor of the state goes to the local congressman and congresswoman and says, you know what, if you stop this donation program or this tax program we have, you know, we're going to end up losing hundreds of millions of dollars. In the state of Massachusetts, the state of Massachusetts had a $400 million shortfall in the early 90s. They were able to, in effect, erase that shortfall by leveraging federal Medicaid dollars. So this became a very important financing tool for states, and it exacerbated the intergovernmental tension between the states and the federal government for obvious reasons. Any questions on how these work? Yeah.
Just to be clear, it was a legal mechanism for states to do
this. It was legal. Yes. It was perfectly legal. Congress then, in 92 and 93, significantly limited the ability of states to do that in response to the president and the executive branch's concerns that this was inappropriate. And so they significantly restricted, but every time Congress would restrict the ability of states to do it, states would figure out another way. And in fact, this debate is still going on today, as we'll talk about in 2006. Okay. Yeah?
How are the taxes set? Are they differently determined for each type of procedure?
No. Originally, states could do whatever they wanted in terms of taxes. Then what Congress did was, and so states would actually impose taxes on some hospitals and not others. You know, it was really, one of the things that Congress did in 92, 93 is so that if you do have special state taxes on providers, they have to be uniform, they can't be, you know, there's all sorts of rules as to how the taxes work, which were efforts by Congress to limit the state's ability to engage in this kind of activity. But it's been an ongoing gamesmanship effort. Okay. 1992, Bill Clinton is elected president. And, make sure I'm still on here. Yeah. And Clinton had been a governor, as you all know, in Arkansas prior to becoming president. And Clinton, unlike Bush and Reagan before him, Clinton was very anxious to have national health insurance through the front door. He didn't want Medicaid expansions anymore. What he wanted was national health insurance at the front door. And we're going to be talking about the Clinton plan for national insurance next week, which, of course, failed. But so Clinton comes in and says, you know what? I don't want more Medicaid mandates. I'm an ex-governor. I know what it's like to be, you know, the head of a state, which is being, you know, given mandate after mandate after mandate by the federal government. I have a whole different model in mind. No more Medicaid mandates, more discretion for the states again. And so beginning in 1992, you begin what I would call the third Medicaid era. And during this third Medicaid era, which went from 1992 to the year 2001, to late 2001, the hallmark of this era was fewer mandates on the states, efforts by the Clinton administration to actually repeal some of the mandates on the states. Another thing that you saw happen during this 8-year period was Medicaid enrollment began to decline. Why do you think Medicaid enrollment declined during the mid-90s? Okay, so one comment, one point, which is right on target, and in case you couldn't hear it, is that in 1996, Congress passed what was known as welfare reform, which was designed to fundamentally change the way the nation's welfare system worked, cash assistance welfare system worked. And as a result of welfare, prior to welfare reform, anybody who was on cash assistance welfare was automatically eligible for Medicaid. They would just get their Medicaid card every month or whatever it was. After welfare reform, all those people were still eligible for Medicaid, but they actually had to affirmatively sign up, and lots of people didn't sign up. So welfare reform was one reason the Medicaid rolls fell. Anybody have another thought as to another reason? Yeah. The economy was strong. I mean, the economy was booming in the mid-90s. And so as the economy was booming and more people got jobs, more people had access to employer-sponsored insurance, and less people needed Medicaid. So the Medicaid rolls during the mid-90s begin to decline a little bit. The states actually have a lot of money in the mid-90s. Unlike the late 80s, early 90s, when the states were struggling with the recession, were struggling with budget deficits, were struggling with fiscal uncertainty, were struggling with declining tax revenue, by the mid-late 90s, states and the federal government themselves both had budget surpluses. And so in the mid-late 90s, states were actually looking to try to sign up people who were eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled. They were looking to expand programs, public insurance programs. The whole dynamic changed dramatically. States had more discretion. They were pushing managed care. They were pushing health insurance expansions. In 1997, Congress enacted what is known as the State Child Health Insurance Program, or the SCHIP program, which again we'll talk about more next week when we do the uninsured, but which was a $40 billion expansion of public insurance nationwide. So the mid-late 90s was a period in which budget surpluses were everywhere, the economy was strong, there were fewer people on welfare, Medicaid costs were declining, and Medicaid costs were declining, number one, because enrollment was declining, number two, because managed care was having a little bit of an effect on the healthcare system and the Medicaid system. Number three, because healthcare inflation more generally was low. So for all those reasons, healthcare costs and Medicaid costs were stabilized. So instead of having 25% annual increases as you had in the early 90s, by the late 90s, you were having 4 or 5% increases in costs in an environment in which the states and the federal government had plenty of money. So Medicaid pretty much just went off the political agenda. You know, it was no longer a crisis by the mid-late 90s. Everything was hunky-dory. So that was the third Medicaid era. Of course, late 2001, the world changes very much in many, many ways. Obviously, it's September 11th here in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. There's war that begins in Afghanistan and then Iraq. The economy goes into a tailspin. There's a recession that begins. State tax revenues, which were booming in the late 90s, all of a sudden, by the early 2000s, were plunging. So all of a sudden, the early 2000s begin to look a lot like the late 1980s. There's another Bush who's president. I mean, it's actually very similar in lots of ways. You know, when you look at the economy, when you look at the political system and the like, there's budget deficits at the state level, there's budget deficits at the federal level, there's tax cuts, which exacerbate the budget deficits. And times are really tough for states. Times are really tough for budget officials. Times are really tough. Medicaid enrollment now starts to zip up again. Remember, so you had a situation where, you know, from 1965 to 1987, 88, Medicaid enrollment was pretty much steady. In the late 80s, early 90s, it practically doubles. It goes way up because of these mandates. Then mid-90s, late 90s, it goes down because of welfare reform. The economy is strong. Early 2000s, it starts going up again. Number one, the economy is not strong again. You know, the economy is in trouble again. People are losing their jobs. Employers are left and right dropping health insurance. We'll talk about this more when we do the uninsured. But, the number of people with employer-sponsored health insurance begins to significantly decline as the employer-sponsored system really undergoes a crisis, or at least comes close to a crisis. Medicaid costs start zooming up again. They start zooming up, number one, because enrollment's going up again. They start zooming up because prescription drug costs are really escalating at 15-20% a year. They start zooming up because changing demographics and long-term care costs and chronic care costs are zooming up again. So early 2000s, you have a situation in which costs are going way up, revenue is way down, and of course that creates a budget crisis, a serious budget crisis. Now, one of the things that the states try to do, and in fact do in the early 2000s, is use some of the leveraging techniques that I was describing a few minutes ago in an even more draconian, more dramatic fashion. Let me just give you an example, just to give you a sense of how much money is involved in some of these efforts by the states, and really how significant they are, and why President Bush and the federal government is so upset about some of this stuff. In the year 2000, in Pennsylvania, just to give you an example, here's what Pennsylvania did, the state of Pennsylvania. Throughout Pennsylvania, there are 23 county nursing homes. These are nursing homes which are basically owned, administered, operated by county governments around the state of Pennsylvania. The state of Pennsylvania gives those 23 nursing homes a reimbursement increase, on Monday at 5 o'clock, say, or Monday at 2 o'clock. I mean, I'm making up the day, but, one afternoon. They give them a reimbursement increase of $697.1 million. They give the 23 nursing homes an extra $697.1 million. That happens at, say, 2 o'clock Monday afternoon. At 2:01 Monday afternoon, again, a little dramatic license here, but basically the next minute, the state of Pennsylvania draws down, because the way Medicaid works is the states, in effect, have an account they can draw down on from the federal government. The states pay the providers 100% of the bill, and then they draw down the federal share of that bill. So in New York, where it's a 50-50 split, the state pays Columbia Presbyterian $100. The state then goes to its account with the feds and it pulls down $50. I mean, it really does this, it doesn't do this on a daily basis, but it sort of draws down the federal share. So Pennsylvania pays these 23 nursing homes $697 million, and it draws down $393.3 million in federal match on that payment. I mean, the federal share of that $697 million payment was $393.3. Everybody with me so far? That's at 2:01 p.m. It's going to be like an episode of 24. Every like 3 minutes, there's going to be another thing happening here. And at the end, I have to kill somebody. I'm sorry. I'll pick one of you out. We'll get to that later. All right. The next minute, at 2:02, you see the screen flashing, 2:02. The 23 county nursing homes cut a check back to the state for $695.6 million. So remember, the nursing homes at 2 o'clock got $697.1 million. A couple of minutes later, they returned to the state $695.6 million. So what that means is at the end of the day, the 23 nursing homes netted $1.5 million. I mean, they got $1.5 million out of this deal, which is basically just like an agent's fee, in effect. So the state gets the $695 million. What that means is the state gets all of its state money back, you know, that it pumped in. Plus, the state now has, it's netted $391.8 million. I mean, again, the federal government, you know, they drew down $393.3 million in federal match. And in effect, now the state has kept $391.8 million of that. And it just goes into state general revenues. And they can do whatever they want with that money. I mean, there are folks who say that the reason the state of New Hampshire has been able to get away with not having an income tax over the last decade is because in New Hampshire they've drawn down so much federal Medicaid money and they're using that Medicaid money on roads and all sorts of other things in the state of New Hampshire.
Excuse me.
Okay. I mean, that's
Medicaid funds
roads in New Hampshire. Now, clearly, now, again, as this was all happening, this was, this was legal. I mean, it's not as if, you know, this was all happening behind somebody's closed doors and somebody's bank accounts were being raided and somebody was going to jail over this. Although, obviously, you know, federal officials were enormously and are enormously upset about this and have been trying very hard to stop it, although it's very, very, very political. So, for example, when George Bush became president, the current George Bush became president in the year 2000, he was upset about some of these kinds of things going on. And so Wisconsin was one of the states that was among the worst quote-unquote violators here. They were actually engaged in this kind of activity as much, if not more, than, you know, most other states. And so what the federal government did was it tried to stamp out a lot of this activity, but it gave a exemption or a waiver to the state of Wisconsin. Now, why do you think Wisconsin ended up getting a waiver? Anybody know who the Secretary of Health and Human Services was? Tommy Thompson. And what had been Tommy Thompson's job prior to becoming Secretary of HHS? He was the governor of Wisconsin. So these are very, very, very political battles that are going on throughout the country right now as we speak. And again, it gets very complicated because not every state is doing what Pennsylvania did. There are states in which they're drawing on New Hampshire. There are states which are using this excess, which are drawing down additional federal dollars and using the federal dollars to expand coverage for the uninsured or to pay safety net public hospitals more reimbursement so they can treat the uninsured. It's not as if every state is using this money to build roads. You know, a number of states are using these techniques to actually expand eligibility or to, you know, to do quote-unquote good things from the state's perspective. I mean, I interviewed, as part of this project I'm working for, there's this big battle that went on for a long time between the feds and the state of Missouri. Tom Scully becomes the head of CMS, the head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services under the Bush administration. And Scully claims when he comes into office that the state of Missouri has, in effect, in his words, defrauded the federal government out of $2 billion over the last decade through these kind of leveraging activities. And so, in effect, Scully says he's going to take the state of Missouri to court and he wants $2 billion, you know, the $2 billion plus damages. Now, it's very interesting because, of course, who was the governor of Missouri when all of these activities began in the early 1990s? It was John Ashcroft. You know, and I actually spoke with someone about Ashcroft, and I changed my mind. There's certain lines I shouldn't cross here. But, you know, but the trouble was Scully could rant and rave all he wanted about how Missouri was, in his words, defrauding the federal government. And yet, when you go down to Columbia or Missouri and you talk, or Jefferson City, Missouri, and you talk to the Missouri state officials, they were and they are enormously proud of what they did. Because they went from a situation in the late 80s, early 90s, in which the state of Missouri ranked 48th in the country in Medicaid eligibility coverage. 48th in the country. They had a very ungenerous program. and they paid hospitals very low rates. They leveraged money during the 1990s, and they now have one of the most generous Medicaid programs in the country in terms of eligibility, in terms of coverage of low-income populations. And so from their point of view, everything they did was perfectly legal, and they used it to actually expand coverage to uninsured people in the state of Missouri. So they think they really did good, and they said to Tom Scully, take us to court. We don't care. We'll win. Because everything we've done, you know, we crossed the T's, we dotted the I's, we did it exactly the way we had to do it. And at the end of the day, not only was Scully sort of wrong legally, I mean, because in fact Missouri was right on there, but politically, you know, for the feds to try to take $2 billion away from the state of Missouri, I mean, it's something the Bush administration, Bush didn't want that battle with the state of Missouri, not when he was running for re-election in 2004. So Scully basically abandoned the effort, and Missouri is continuing to push ahead. Now, there are, you know, there have been efforts by the federal government to clamp down on some of these practices. And it's interesting, whoever you talk to, I've spoken to probably the last four or five people who've run sort of CMS or HCFA. In fact, I'll probably bring this up again tomorrow morning. I'm meeting on something else with Bruce Laddick, who actually ran HCFA under the Clinton administration. It was public. And whether it was the Clinton administration folks or the Bush administration folks, they all hated this stuff. This isn't a Democratic conservative, Democratic Republican issue. It's a federal state issue. Yeah. Well, you see, these county nursing homes they're public entities. And again, I don't really want to get too much into the details of this because it gets very, 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 very complicated. But basically, since they're public entities, they were able to engage in what are known as intergovernmental transfers. They could just transfer through this intergovernmental transfer from one governmental entity at the county to another governmental entity at the state. And so basically, it's as if they had received all this money in Medicaid reimbursement, but then they were making an intergovernmental transfer to the state of Pennsylvania. And there was nothing that prohibited intergovernmental transfers. I mean, it's kind of like, I remember being so chagrined. I was this young lawyer. I was one of, you know, I had started out, and I got this job. I was working for the city of New York, and I got this case to sue the state of New York. Because I did all my litigation when I was working for the city was suing the state or suing the federal government. So I had this case where I was suing the state for like we were suing them for $25 million. So, but this, it's not even important what we were suing them for. But we actually won, you know, a $20 million judgment against the state. And I was like the happiest guy in New York. I mean, I thought, you know, I'm like the coolest guy. Here I am. I'm 25 years old or whatever it is. I've just sued the state of New York. I've won $20 million. You know, John Grisham has nothing on me. You know, I was just set. I actually knew someone, though, you know, who worked for the state. And like a couple of months go by, and I'm sort of still thinking I'm a pretty cool guy. And I see this guy I know at the state budget office. And he says to me, you know, not that I want to burst your bubble or anything like that, but, you know, I know you think you're pretty cool because you won $20 million, except let me tell you what we did. We just basically took the $20 million that we had to pay you under that judgment. We just took that $20 million. You know, and he showed me where in the state budget they, in effect, deducted $20 million from what they paid to the state of New York. I mean, to the city of New York. So they basically had just, you know, taken the money back. And one of the things that taught me is that when you're looking at sort of the way American government works and the way intergovernmental relations work, you know, and sort of the hundreds of billions of dollars that sort of are caught up in these intergovernmental back and forth situations between the states, the feds, the local governments, etc. A lot of this money is just completely fungible. I mean, it gets in one pot, and it gets in another pot, and it gets in another pot. And so one of the things I realized at that point was that in the litigation context, you know, we the lawyers, when we were suing the state, it really was, we were bargaining chips. You know, we were bringing litigation really to pressure the state in a political way, not so much in a budgetary way. So anyway, similarly, it was through that kind of intergovernmental transfer, which is legal now. The feds are trying very hard to limit these kind of intergovernmental transfers. in significant ways. And they have, over the last decade, limited the ability of states to engage in a variety of these kinds of practices. But there's this ongoing back and forth that's still going on today. All right. So by the early to mid-2000s, you know, in the last couple of years, all of a sudden we were in this situation in which states had no money, Medicaid costs were escalating, states were trying to use these leveraging techniques, but they were battles, because every time they tried, the feds were fighting them on it. And the states actually, while they were getting some money, the states were looking bad politically, because it was looking like the states were getting away with something they shouldn't get away with. They were like tricking, or, if, you know, while it wasn't legally considered fraud, it, you know, the Tom Scullys of the world had sort of the moral high ground, saying the states were engaged in inappropriate activity. And so at both the state level and the federal level, over the last couple of years, the question has begun to sort of drive policymakers, and the question is, what do we do about Medicaid? How do we get a control of Medicaid costs? How do we get a control of the Medicaid program? I mean, now the program, you know, has 52 million beneficiaries. It's a $300 billion plus program. It covers more and more long-term care costs. It covers, you know, formerly middle-class folks. We'll talk about that when we get to long-term care. You know, it's got this, you know, if you look at the trends, people say, oh my gosh, it's just going to end up, you know, eating up, along with Medicare, you know, all this money. What do we do about Medicaid? We'll get to what do we do about Medicare in a little bit. But what do we do about Medicaid has become a very big, very important, very topical issue in the health policy world these days. So let's go through, actually. I'm going to ask you, and then we're going to write down what we could do, what some of the options are around Medicaid. What can we do about Medicaid? What to sort of get a hold of Medicaid costs? If you're a state official, if you're a federal official, what are some of the choices? Somebody give me a choice. Excuse me? Okay, so one thing you could do is you could try to cut benefits. Now, let's sort of talk about these as we go through them. The federal government tells the states there are certain services you have to provide, and there are other services that are optional, up to the state. We talked about this last week. So states have, in fact, let me just give you an example. A number of states have said, you know, we have to cut benefits in significant ways. So in 2006, for example, there are 16 states that are planning benefit cutbacks. I mean, the state of Indiana is cutting dental benefits. The state of Missouri is cutting dental and podiatry and vision. The state of Maine is cutting podiatry, mental health, and durable medical equipment. You know, so 16 states in 2006 and other states in 2005 and other states in 2004 have been cutting benefits. And again, the kind of benefits they usually cut are things like mental health coverage, dental coverage, podiatry, you know, those kind of things. So what's some of the pros and some of the cons of these kind of cutbacks? Is this a good idea, bad idea? What do you think? Yeah. So, in effect, one thing, and again, for those of you who couldn't hear the comment, you know, there's lots of folks who are on Medicaid. I mean, lots of the homeless aren't on Medicaid, unfortunately. They probably should be, but they're not. But say you've got a lot of folks who are on Medicaid and low income have, you know, mental health problems of one sort or another. If you cut mental health benefits, you could save a few bucks in the short term. Although you're not going to save a whole lot of money in the short term, so it's not like states spend all that much on mental health and dental and podiatry. I mean, the big money is in hospital care and long nursing home care, etc. So you could save a few bucks cutting mental health. On the other hand, it could end up coming back to cost you more money if folks who need mental health services don't get those services, sort of flip out and end up in the emergency room of some hospital. You know, so it's similarly dental care. You could end up saving a few bucks by cutting dental services, except as every dentist in the world will tell you, you know, you start cutting dental services, particularly to kids, it's going to have medical implications for those kids. It's going to actually play itself out. Go ahead. Did you have a...
Yeah,
That was okay. Did you have another comment that you were going to? Okay. So anyway, one thing you could do is cut benefits, but whether or not that's really a good idea or a bad idea, I don't know. Yeah.
I think what you say is the dietary is the fact that people who are diabetic need to have screen checked out. And I think what you use problems going forward is diabetic problems.
Absolutely. The comment was, you know, you cut the dietary. What about, I don't know how many of you saw the series in the Times a couple of weeks ago about sort of the diabetes crisis here in New York City and around the country, and sort of the how we're pretty good at, you know, paying for expensive hospital care that's often too late, but we're not so good at sort of prevention, you know, catching things early on. And here, so you cut podiatry. You might say to yourself, geez, I'm going to save a few bucks. I'm going to cut podiatry. But again, you can have significant public health implications. You can have significant cost implications. You can have significant implications for diabetics down the line. Yeah, way in the back. That I don't know. You just do you know the? I mean, the question was how many diabetics see podiatrists, and I don't know the answer to that. What?
All of them should.
All of them should.
Regularly.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean the podiatrists and diabetics. That's basically all of them. Do. I mean, the general doctor looks at them, but
okay.
They have
okay. So it sounds like, again, I think most of you know more about this particular thing than I do, and it certainly makes sense what you're saying.
The other thing is, for industry, I live in the New York, and there's so many cases that come in, like in the hospital,
out
in the county hospital, we didn't provide insulin care. And so you come to the emergency room late at night, there's a lot of people get there too.
Right.
And you have to think about that, like how much money are they spending to see these patients in the ER. Right.
Right, I agree. Yeah.
Could you, although this probably isn't very popular, could you increase? I'm trying to think about this. Could you change the threshold of who you provide services to?
Mm-hmm.
So, instead of saying that people can cover it if you're 50% below the poverty level or something, change it to, I don't know.
Okay, I thought you were about to say something else, but there's two things. Okay, there's two things there. One, you could certainly talk about eligibility, and we're going to talk about eligibility. We'll talk about eligibility next. I thought you were, and you can cut eligibility, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I thought you were going to say something else about benefits, which is you could actually cut, you could make it more difficult for folks to access certain kind of benefits. For example, long-term care benefits. Most states, before they'll pay for you to go into a nursing home or before they'll pay for you to get home care services, they'll require a nurse or a social worker or somebody to do an assessment of you. You know, how many activities of daily living can you engage? You know, whatever it is, some sort of needs assessment. And they can, by ratcheting up or ratcheting down, you know, the needs assessment, you can actually keep the benefit on the book. So you could say we're going to cover podiatry, but you have to have a diagnosis of diabetes in order to be eligible to get that service covered or something like that. You know, you could try to impose some limits on the benefit itself. Yeah?
In terms of benefits, I mean, co-pays are a good way to keep people from, if a diabetic needs a diet every year, you don't need to keep the diet 10 times a year.
Okay. So another thing you could do around benefits, so one is you can impose... Well, you could try to impose co-pays. Now, federal law, pretty much up until last week anyway, we'll talk about this in a few minutes, but federal law limits significantly the extent of co-pays. You can't impose co-pays on kids. You can't impose co-pays more than $3. You know, Medicaid, unlike in the private sector, where, you know, private insurance companies are ratcheting up more and more and more co-pays and premiums and all sorts of stuff, in the Medicaid world, historically, there have been significant limits on the ability to impose co-pays. But at the top of the agenda for a lot of federal and state officials is to increase the ability to use co-pays for precisely the purpose that you're talking about. Yeah.
Sort of more expendable
I think the issue is states are struggling to figure out when states cover cut mental health. Typically, they don't say we're not going to cover any mental health at all. What they say is, in effect, we're going to cut, instead of covering, you know, 20 days of services, we're going to cover 5 days. You know, they cut back on the allowable mental health services that they will pay for, and they say, you know, times are tough. You know, and again, it's a very political question. I mean, it's very tough politically. You know, you're talking about cutting dental. Well, most dentists don't participate in the Medicaid program because the reimbursement rates for Medicaid for dentistry are extremely low. And so dentists don't, you know, when Medicaid talks about cutting dentistry, there's not a constituency of dentists out there to say, hey, don't cut dentistry, you know, out of Medicaid. So it becomes easier politically to do that. It's the same, yeah, I mean, it's primarily clinics. Well, mental health actually has a little more of a constituency than dentistry does. But yeah, these become very, very political battles around co-pays, around the service themselves, around needs assessment. One other thing, yeah, go ahead.
Well, just to move forward.
Sure.
You can negotiate for lower prices for services or products. You know, one
All right, well, let me start to throw in a couple of things here because we've been talking about a few things here. So on benefits, again, you can cut the actual service, you can impose co-pays, you can also do what the state of Utah does. And again, remember, the current Secretary of Health and Human Services is the former governor of Utah. So the Utah case is being looked to very closely by policymakers around the country right now as a potential example of where the federal government wants the states to go. And what Utah is doing is, in effect, they have two benefit programs, two benefit packages. What Utah said is we want to cut benefits to healthy adults. We want to cut benefits to under the Medicaid program generally, you're supposed to have the same benefit package for everybody. And what Utah has said is it doesn't make sense to have the same benefit package for everybody. We should try to have tailored benefit packages depending on the different different populations. Utah is the only state in the country that has permission to do this right now. But it's something that other states are looking at and want to move towards. Yeah. Absolutely. Co-payment, co-payments, in general, Medicaid has historically significantly limited co-pays, but to the extent they're allowed more for higher income beneficiaries than for lower income beneficiaries. All right, so that's all around benefits. So there's a whole range of things you can do around benefits. Then somebody said, what about eligibility? Well, you know, there's two different kinds of things you can do around eligibility. One, you could just cut the rolls. You could sort of say, we're going to cut, instead of covering people up to 100% of the poverty level, we're going to cover people up to 80% of the poverty level. Or, you know, instead of covering adults up to 200% of the poverty level, we're going to cut them to 150. You know, you could cut the income eligibility levels. Explicit cutbacks. That's one thing you could do. You could also implicitly cut eligibility through the back door. What do I mean by that? What do you think I mean by that? How do you cut eligibility through the back door? Well, you make it tougher to sign up, to enroll in the program. You impose administrative hurdles. You don't actually cut the eligibility levels, but you require more paperwork. You require more, you know, evidence of eligibility. Yeah. There's been sort of a back and forth over these efforts over the years. I mean, after welfare reform, there were all sorts of, you know, the state of California in 97, 98 had a 27-page Medicaid application. Very difficult to fill out, long, complicated, a pain in the neck. In the late 90s, when the economy of California was strong, they had a surplus, there was money around everywhere, you know, the politics were very different, they cut that 27-page application down to 2 pages. Made it much easier to sign up. They required much less documentation. They didn't have to provide pay stubs. They didn't have to do this. They didn't have to do that. Much, you know, the goal was to make the door easier to navigate through. Now the times are tough again. you know, many states around the country are trying to make it tougher again. They're going back to the 20-page applications. You can use, without actually going to the legislature and saying, we want to cut eligibility levels for Medicaid beneficiaries, you can administratively ratchet up or ratchet down eligibility levels through the use of sort of the oversight you have of the enrollment process. So states are doing that. Now, what's the sort of pros and the cons of cutting eligibility if you're running a Medicaid program? Yeah. So one problem is, you know, say you're the state of Arkansas. If somebody's on Medicaid, every medical bill they incur when they show up at the hospital, the federal government pays 80% of that bill. And you, the state of Arkansas, pay 20% of that bill. You cut that person off of Medicaid, what happens? They're going to become uninsured. That person then shows up at the hospital. The hospital provides a service to them. The hospital can't submit a bill to anybody. The state, instead of having the federal government pay 80% of that bill to the local hospital, now the hospital is engaged in providing uncompensated care. So the hospital is losing money, the hospital is in trouble, and there's federal dollars not coming into the states. So there's a real disincentive. Medicaid has a real disincentive to cutting the eligibility rolls. Of course, you know, and of course, making someone else uninsured doesn't help you. It may save you a few bucks, but it's not exactly an ideal policy outcome. So eligibility, again, a lot of states are cutting back. Now, where states are cutting when it comes to eligibility, and a number of states are cutting, where they're cutting primarily is adult eligibility. Very few states are cutting any child eligibility, at least explicitly. They might be making it a little bit tougher to get in the door for everybody, figuring that when the economy gets a little better, they'll sort of remove some of those obstacles and make it easier again. But they're making it very tough to get in. But they're not cutting explicitly kids. But there are some cutbacks of sort of healthy adults. But not nearly as many eligibility cutbacks as advocates worried about. As advocates worried about, in large part because of some of these financial things that we're just talking about. Someone else said we can cut reimbursement. So you can cut reimbursement to hospitals, you can cut reimbursement to doctors, to nursing homes. You can actually cut, you know, again, cut reimbursement as another strategy if you're a Medicaid director. Except that, too, isn't exactly the greatest strategy. I mean, number one, the hospitals are already getting less reimbursement from Medicare. They're getting less reimbursement from private insurers. They're saying they're going broke. You know, the nursing homes are saying they're going broke. They're very politically influential in your town and your city and your community. So politically, it's very tough to cut reimbursement. It's also the case that more and more states are paying managed care plans, and then the managed care plans are actually paying the hospitals and paying the doctors. So states have actually less and less leverage over reimbursement as more and more of that dollar goes through managed care plans. Somebody else said drugs. You can try to cut the cost of drugs. And there's lots of things. In fact, this has been probably the area that states have been most active in over the last 4 or 5 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll come to that in a minute. There's a whole nother, yep, we'll come to that in just a minute. Let's just talk about drugs for 1 second, then we'll come to the chronically ill. How do you cut drug costs? Yeah. So one thing you could do is try to increase reliance on generics. You can also, and here it gets a little interesting, under federal law, you're not allowed in the Medicaid program to have a formulary. You're not allowed to simply have a list of drugs A to Z and say everybody on Medicaid has to get drugs A to Z. However, you are allowed to have what's known as a preferred drug list. And the only difference between a formulary and a preferred drug list is that in a preferred drug list, the doctor is told, here's a list of the drugs we want you to prescribe, and you could prescribe any of these drugs you want without getting any permission from us. However, if there's a brand name drug or if there's some other drug that you really want your patient to have, you can call the following 1-800 number and speak to a nurse or speak to somebody in our Medicaid office, and if you can convince them, you can get, you know, that drug for that patient. On the other hand, of course, particularly, you know, in provider offices and clinics that are overwhelmed with patients and doctors that are overwhelmed with low-income patients, they don't really want to have to sit on the phone for 3 hours at some 1-800 number. So the impact of a preferred drug list is very much the same as the impact of a formulary. It really changed, you know, and so drug companies very much want to be on the PDL. So preferred drug lists are a very effective way, particularly if they're combined with generics and other things, to actually cut pharmaceutical spending, to cut Medicaid costs. How else can you cut drug costs? Somebody mentioned reimportation of drugs from Canada. The trouble is, it's illegal to do that. Which doesn't mean that people don't do it. I mean, it's pretty amazing. You know, you cross the border into Mexico, you cross the border into Canada. I mean, the first thing you often see are these pharmacies saying, you know, get your Lipitor here or whatever. But, there's been big battles over reimportation, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the semester. But right now, reimportation is definitely illegal. Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's true. I don't think that's true, but they spend an awful lot of money on marketing. That part of it is true. And we're going to talk about drugs more when we talk about the Medicare drug bill, and we're actually going to talk about why drug costs have been going up so much. And this is a debate we're going to be coming to. Clearly, marketing is part of the story. Clearly, increased utilization is part of this. I mean, there's lots of reasons that are research and development. There's lots of reasons that are part of the story. Rather than sort of get us into the nuts and bolts as to why drug costs are going up, I'd rather simply say that from the state's point of view, they don't really have the power to control pharmaceutical marketing. The federal government does, and they've been reluctant to do much in that arena recently. Yeah. Okay, so let me just sort of add that as another category, in effect. And I'll come back to that in a minute. That's true. All right, but in drugs, a couple of other things you can do around drugs. And I don't want to say you can't get at marketing, but it's very tough for Medicaid agencies to actually get at marketing costs. But what Medicaid agencies can do is try to form purchasing pools with other states. Yeah. Absolutely. You can, and that's where you can, by using a preferred drug list, you can in effect create a formulary which says we're going to try to significantly cut back the kind of drugs that we cover in our program. Absolutely. But on the purchasing pools, what a number of states have said is let's combine our buying power with other states so that we in New England, you know, we'll get all our states together. Are we here? Are we there? We'll combine our purchasing power. Now, these efforts to combine their purchasing power have just taken a big hit because everybody who's on Medicaid and also Medicare has now been taken off of Medicaid drugs and they're getting their drugs through Medicare. But we'll talk about that again when we get to the Medicare drug bill. But states have been trying to create purchasing pools. And then there are various complicated things which you don't have to know all the details of. Basically, states can try to reduce the reimbursement they pay to pharmacists for drugs, for prescription drugs. They can just pay less. And there's been a big effort to try to change the way states and the federal government pay pharmacists, you know, for the cost of drugs. So there's been a lot of activity around prescription drugs in terms of trying to cut costs. A couple other comments people made. There's no question that the chronically ill drive a lot of the costs in Medicaid and healthcare more generally. And there's probably the biggest buzzword in Medicaid these days is disease management, whatever that means, and care management. And, of course, managed care. And so there's increased efforts in just about every state to try to manage the chronically ill, to try to use disease management and care management to actually get a handle on some of the real high-cost beneficiaries that you have that are costing the program a significant amount of money. Someone else mentioned, in effect, the comment around the states and prisons and Medicaid. I mean, obviously, fraud and abuse is another area that states are spending a lot of time and a lot of money looking at. Here in New York, again, you may remember a few months ago, the New York Times ran these big sort of exposés as to, you know, this dentist in Brooklyn, I think it was, who, you know, was filling 832 teeth in one afternoon or whatever. I mean, she was remarkably efficient or there was some fraud going on, and I think clearly it was the latter. And there's clearly a fair amount of fraud and abuse in the system. Interestingly, almost all of the fraud is at the provider level. It's not at the beneficiary level. I mean, there are some people who end up on Medicaid who are probably not eligible for the program. That certainly happens. But the big money and the significant effort to deal with this issue is around provider fraud. And again, a lot of it is not simply fraud. I mean, there's really, when I say fraud and abuse, there's a lot of gamesmanship that goes on. So that, you know, providers and hospitals and others, you know, they're not out to break the law, but they're out to, if they can game the system, they'll certainly try to game the system. I mean, I always tell the story of how when I first started working here at Presbyterian, at Columbia, and then obviously here at Presbyterian as well, they used to have this newsletter that would come out once a month. And in the newsletter, among other things, well, maybe it was quarterly, but it would come out regularly. In the newsletter, among other things, there would be a section, and that section would be called the DRG of the month. And what that meant is DRGs, and we're not going to get into this in detail right now, but DRGs are codes that are used in the Medicare program to determine how much Medicare will reimburse a hospital for seeing a particular patient. And so DRGs are basically based on the diagnosis of the patient. So if somebody presents, they show up at the hospital with the following set of symptoms, they're code 7. If they have a broken leg, they're code 9. If they have a heart attack, they're code 14. And for each code, there's a different payment amount due for that code. Well, what the DRG of the month was a little section which basically said, you know, if Jane Doe appears with the following symptoms and diagnosis, you know, you can't code her as a code 38. And as a code 38, we here at the hospital will get $100. Or, you know, she's really also, it's sort of ambiguous enough, she could also probably be a code 62. And if she's a code 62, we get $1 million. Now, we're not going to tell you what to do, but this is just some basic information. And so, of course, you know, we here at the School of Public Health and Department of Health Policy and Management, one of the things that we do is we train people to go out and work for consulting firms and for hospitals and to be revenue generators for hospitals and other places. And their job is to figure out how to generate as much revenue as possible. There are times when the line gets a little dicey as to what's legit and what's not legit. So it's not always clear fraud. It's not always the crook, the outright crook. It's oftentimes the clinic that's really just trying to, I mean, it's kind of like when I was a kid. I mean, it's not exactly like it, but whatever. You know, and we had just regular indemnity insurance, which meant, and the regular indemnity insurance back then did not pay for any preventive care. So if you showed up for your, just if a mom took a kid to the doctor, this is just like in Blue Cross, just a regular private insurance plan. If you showed up, you know, just for an annual visit, that would not be paid for by the insurance company. So you'd go through this sort of routine where you'd show up at the doctor's office, and the doctor would see you for your well care visit, And then they'd write down sore throat or something like that. You know, they'd sort of just, in effect, make up some little diagnosis, and that way they could get paid. And again, that was fraud. I confess, you know, as an 8-year-old, I guess I participated in that. But, you know, there's the lines here get really sort of really dicey and really tricky. And Medicaid is spending a lot more time trying to discourage abuse and eliminate fraud, or at least make it much more difficult. What else can you do if you're talking about Medicaid? Any other ideas for, yeah? Excuse me? You can raise taxes. You're not going anywhere. But you can raise taxes. Absolutely. No. I mean, you clearly can. There are not too many politicians suggesting that these days. But that's absolutely, you could try to generate more money by raising taxes. Yeah?
For like a specific diagnosis, you can cap how much money you would pay. Like, for a hospital pay, how long you can do
that. Absolutely. And that sort of gets you right back into the reimbursement. Those are some of the kinds of things that that states and others do around reimbursement. They try to get at it through techniques like that. Absolutely. Yeah? Well, you could certainly, and this, we haven't really discussed this in class, so I don't want to get it too much, but under the CHIP program, which is another program that I mentioned was enacted in 1997 by Congress to provide health insurance for people, for families that had income a little bit too high for Medicaid, but not enough for them to afford private insurance, the feds actually contribute a higher reimbursement rate under CHIP than they do under Medicaid. So if you're a state, you certainly have an incentive to try to get as many people sort of off Medicaid and into CHIP. You have an incentive to try to get people off Medicaid and onto the Medicare rolls. You know, have Medicare cover things if you can, because there the feds pay 100% of the bill. And of course, there's all the leveraging things that we talked about before. You could certainly try to do leveraging, you know, of any sort. And that's really what you're talking about. What else can you do? Way in the back, yeah. You can absolutely say, you know what, if we want to deal with this on a long-term basis, we really have to get much more into prevention, into disease management, into care management. Absolutely. You know, you start talking about the diabetics that we were talking about earlier with podiatry and so forth. You really want to have systems of prevention for them. Yeah. Okay, so around, and again, we're going to spend a whole class on long-term care, but you could try to encourage all sorts of alternatives to institutionalization. And then, of course, you can try to encourage more prevention and less specialist care. So, yeah?
You could require all providers to treat Medicaid patients, because right now doctors will oftentimes say the reimbursement is too low, I'm not going to see this patient, and then what happens is that you have a disproportionate share of Medicaid patients being treated by a very small segment of the medical profession.
Mm-hmm. What typically happens, I mean, New York is an interesting case here. New York actually has by far the most expensive Medicaid program in the country, and it ranks 50th in the country, though, in terms of what it pays doctors for a Medicaid visit. And basically what that means is that here in New York, very few docs participate in the Medicaid program, at least in their office-based practices. And what they do instead, Medicaid beneficiaries end up all going to clinics and hospitals, and that's where they get their care, not in offices. So you could try to absolutely say, although whether or not expanding the whether or not it be legal to do that is, you know, you can say to a doctor, if you want to accept a Medicare patient, you're going to also have to accept a Medicaid patient. You know, you could try to find a hook somewhere, but it's not so easy legally to do that, and it certainly would be challenged. Yeah. Okay, well, you know what? The comment was, what about scrapping the system and starting from scratch? And there are certainly people out there now who are saying absolutely that. And, I mean, I, you know, in the context of a different project I was working on, And I'm not saying, I'm saying this in all seriousness. I spent a couple of hours last year with Newt Gingrich, who has made healthcare into his, you know, his big thing now that he wants to run for the presidency on, among other things. And, you know, so he's got, Newt Gingrich has something called the Center for Healthcare Transformation that he started in Georgia. And they're working with folks around the country. And his big thing is to sort of start and sort of reinvent Medicaid from scratch. And what Gingrich is pushing and what a number of states are now trying to adopt is an effort, in effect, I mean, Gingrich is pushing more than this, but one of the things he's pushing and one of the things states, a number of states are pushing for is to convert Medicaid into a voucher program. And so, for example, the state of South Carolina has a waiver request as we speak today before the federal government to convert their to basically abolish their Medicaid program and to convert it into a voucher program in which each Medicaid beneficiary would in effect be given an account of money. It's sort of like a health savings account for Medicaid beneficiaries. They'd be given an account of money, and that the amount of the money would depend on their risk status. So presumably the sicker folks would have more money and the less sick, healthier folks would have less money. Everybody would have a different pot of money. And people would, with that pot of money, they could either use that money on premiums to buy a private health insurance plan, or they could just keep that money in the bank and use it to actually pay for health care services when they needed the health care services. Now, of course, the question comes up, you know, number one, how well would the system work in terms of actuarially, you know, sort of predicting how much it's going to cost? And number two, what happens when people run out of money? And what do you do at that point? You just say no. But in effect, the goal would be there, and this is something that people are talking about in Medicare as well, to convert right now, and this is really an important debate that's going on in health policy these days, and in pension policy, every policy. Right now, programs like Medicare and Medicaid are what's known as defined benefit programs. I mean, basically, there's a benefit package that under the Medicaid program you're entitled to, or under the Medicare program you're entitled to, or under Social Security you're entitled to. It's a defined benefit. And you get that benefit when you become eligible for the program. What a lot of conservatives are saying these days is we ought to convert Medicaid and Medicare and health insurance more generally from a defined benefit to what's known as a defined contribution program, in which government would give a set amount of money to you, and you would use that money, you know, and then when the money ran out, that's it. It's kind of like there's been a big move among private pensions. You know, it used to be that, and it still is for some. I mean, if you're a New York City cop, what is it, after 20 years or whatever, you retire and you get 50% of your salary, whatever, I forget the exact numbers, but it used to be that most workers and unions and most civil service workers and others got a defined benefit when they retired. And it was based on, you work for a number of years and you'll get a percentage of your salary. Most private companies have switched away from defined benefit to defined contribution plans, to 401ks and the like, where instead of saying we're going to pay you 50% of your salary when we retire, they say we're going to give you $100 a month and you invest that in an IRA or a 401k, and if you do a good job of investing and you have a pension at the end of the day, fine, but if you invest in Enron and Enron goes bankrupt, you're out of luck. So there's a big debate about whether or not Medicaid should be reinvented. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the idea would be, number one, there would be a lot of so-called personal responsibility here. I mean, people would supposedly be personally responsible themselves. But number two, there's a recognition that, you know, a lot of Medicaid beneficiaries, nursing home residents, people with Alzheimer's, you know, there's a lot of people who, you know, are really not in a position right now to sort of spend that money in that way. And that's one of the big debates going on right now in the federal government. If they're going to give South Carolina permission to try this experiment, the question is how are they going to regulate it to ensure that people aren't taken advantage of, that money is just spent foolishly, that, you know, what kind of regulatory system is put in place. So South Carolina has not received permission yet to engage in this program. Florida is proposing a similar kind of effort, although not as dramatic as South Carolina's. Yeah.
I was just going to make a comment about my great home state of Florida.
Oh, okay. You there?
They did a similar program for public schools to give incentives for public schools to improve by offering vouchers for people to go to private schools instead.
Right.
And if anyone's ever heard anything about the public education system in Florida, they know it really sucks. Mm-hmm. So, like, if they try to take this sort of program over into healthcare, I think it's going to fall on its face.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way this is going to work out.
We'll see. There's a cut way in the back. Yeah. You, yeah, yeah. Right. Yep. Well, what the states would love would be if the federal government would agree to take over all of the costs for the duly eligible. That's what the National Governors Association has proposed, for example. That's not going to happen, at least anytime soon. But clearly, the duly eligible, those folks who are eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare, are a very high cost population, and getting a handle on them is at the top of the list. Let me just mention a couple of other things real quick that haven't come up yet that there's a lot of talk about. One, we're going to spend a whole lecture on, so I don't want to get into it in great detail, but there's a lot of talk about using health information technology to try to save dollars and improve efficiency and improve quality, you know, whether it's electronic medical records, whether it's computerized physician entry, order entry form. Now, there's all sorts of ways that states and both public and private sectors say we could use information technology to actually have a better, more efficient, cheaper, wiser system. Another effort that was really big a few years ago that has run into some problems, though, are what is known as premium assistance programs. The idea here was that states would use, you know, you have a lot of people who not a lot, but there's a fair amount of people who have jobs, as we'll talk about next week, 80% of the uninsured either work or are the dependents of workers. So a lot of working folks are uninsured, and they work for companies which actually offer them health insurance, except they can't afford to pay, you know, the significant employee share of that health insurance, so they don't take up that health insurance, that private health insurance. So what a number of states have said is, why don't we use Medicaid dollars to pay for the employee share of the private health insurance policy? That way we'd be using just a little bit of Medicaid money to actually leverage a private policy. And so states have been experimenting with these. They're very, very complicated, difficult programs to implement, because for lots of reasons that I won't even get into. So they've gotten off to slow starts. But the idea of trying to use public money to leverage private policies and private dollars is still, I think, pretty high on the agenda. Yeah. Well, I mean, states could, yeah. Well, there you have the debate. One comment was, why don't the state expand minimum wage? The other comment was, well, that's going to mean people lose jobs. Obviously, there's a fierce debate over that. Let me just end the discussion of Medicaid by asking how many people happened to notice, I think it was last Monday, what Congress did, what happened in Congress around this. Anybody notice? Congress actually passed some legislation designed to significantly save Medicaid dollars. The president hasn't signed it yet, but it's sort of now passed both the Senate and the House and is going to be signed by the president in the next few days. They passed a budget, and what did they, anybody know what so Congress had all of these options on the table. Congress picked some of these. Anybody happen to follow what Congress did? Yeah. Okay. So let's write down what Congress did. They said, number one, we're going to increase copays, and we're going to actually allow premiums for some Medicaid enrollees. Now, of course, the Democrats have been, and this was very controversial, the Democrats say, well, you know what, this is another way of cutting eligibility. Because if you start imposing premiums, Medicaid beneficiaries are just not going to pay them, and they're going to get cut off the rolls. If you impose copays, while saying a $5 copay for an office visit isn't much, if you've got a woman with five kids and she has to take the five kids to the doctor, that's $25. She might not do it. That's the argument back and forth there. But clearly Congress has said, you know, we want to impose copays and premiums. That's one thing they did. What else did they do? Anybody know? Yeah. Well, they didn't really cut them. No, they didn't cut benefits.
Well, not exactly, but they lowered the funding. Like, they subtracted the traumatic brain injury program and a couple other ones and said, oh, all those funds will be in the maternal and child block grant. The amount of money is actually less than earlier.
Okay, now that sounds right, although around Medicaid, they did do something around benefits and Medicaid in particular, though. Okay. So the amount of funding for certain. No, I mean, so funding for certain programs. Another thing that they did around benefits was they specifically gave states the ability to have flexible benefit packages. So you're going to see states experimenting with flexible benefit packages. A third thing that Congress did was it said, we want to cut the cost of prescription drugs, and the way we're going to do that is we're going to lower reimbursement to pharmacists. So they changed the formula under which pharmacists who hand out the drugs to Medicaid enrollees, they changed the formula under which the pharmacists are reimbursed, so there's going to be a reimbursement cut to the pharmacist. That's how they're going to try to save drug money. A fourth thing they did, I'm writing TOA here, that stands for transfer of assets, and we'll get to this when we get to long-term care, but they're trying to reduce the ability of seniors to transfer their assets to become eligible for Medicaid. That's the fourth thing they did. And a fifth thing they did was they basically said that in order to prove your eligibility, you had to show either a passport or a birth certificate. And, of course, they couch this. Basically, the argument is here that they're trying to get undocumented aliens and so forth. But, you know, by imposing it's sort of an implicit way that, in effect, is going to cut some eligibility also, because a lot of low-income people, particularly low-income immigrants, even if they're here legally, we're going to have trouble coming up with that additional documentation. So these were all cuts. They did increase funding a little bit in certain ways. They increased some funding for victims of Katrina in Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and a couple other states. So there was more involved in what Congress did than just this. There was some of the program cuts that you're mentioning back and forth on. So there was other things back and forth, but in terms of the big efforts, you know, the copays, the benefits, the drugs, the transferring of assets, I mean, those were really the big changes that Congress passed last week. And these were, it was a very, very, very close vote. It was a very close vote. I don't know if I, let me see if I brought, I didn't, here, wait. I don't think I brought the numbers with me. But it was something like, I don't know, 208 to 206, you know, both in the Senate and in the House, it was so close that, Cheney was ready to go to the Senate to break a tie, and in the House, you know, it was unclear what was going to happen. There was a lot of both Democratic and sort of moderate Republican opposition to these changes, you know, and all these changes, but they passed. And they're going to be signed by the president. What they'll mean over time, I don't really know. I mean, who knows how significant they'll be over time. But this is what Congress has picked as the areas they want to focus in on. The Bush administration had three main priorities it was pushing for. They were pushing for reduced transfer of assets. They were pushing for reduced drug expense costs. And the third that they were pushing for was increased efforts to cut down on the leveraging activities that I talked about early at the beginning of the hour. The Congress really didn't go along with the administration as much on that for reasons that we talked about earlier. So that's really Medicaid. Any final questions or comments on Medicaid right now? All right, why don't we take a break and then we'll come back and talk about Medicare. Back up again now. Can I get your attention, everybody? We're going to start back up. You can find a seat. All right, we're going to switch gears now, and we're going to talk about Medicare. Make sure this is working right. It seems to be working right. Okay. Medicare, also enacted in 1965, provides health insurance to about 42 million elderly and disabled Americans. Provides health insurance to about 35 million or so folks over the age of 65, about 6 million or so young disabled, and then there's about 500,000 or so who buy into the Medicare program. And the reason they buy into it is you're automatically eligible for Medicare when you hit the age of 65, say, if you've contributed or your spouse has contributed to the Medicare trust fund, to the Medicare tax system for 10 years or 40 quarters. But if you haven't, then you could still buy, you know, if you came to the country later or for whatever reason you haven't, you know, contributed to that tax system, you could still buy into the program. So there's about 500,000 people who do that because it's a pretty good deal financially. It's better than being uninsured, and it's affordable. So it's about 42 million Americans. It's a $300 billion plus program, growing larger and more expensive, obviously, by the day. Very different from Medicaid. Medicare builds off of the Social Security model. It's a social insurance program. Everybody who pays into the system, whether they're low income, middle income, or multimillionaire, everybody who pays into the system is eligible for Medicare coverage, regardless of your income. So one big difference between Medicare and Medicaid, Medicaid, remember, is means tested. You have to be low income to be eligible for Medicaid. Medicare, there's no means testing for eligibility. everybody's eligible for the program. Another difference between Medicare and Medicaid is that, remember, in Medicaid, the states administer the program, and the states kick in, you know, 20 to 50% of the bill. Medicare is administered by the federal government, not the states. Now, the feds will hire sometimes, they hire third-party administrators, they hire some private insurers to help them administer, but basically it's the federal government that administers the program. The federal government makes all the rules around the program. The rules are uniform nationally, so you don't have the interstate variation that you have in Medicaid. So you've got a program that's federally administered with a series of uniform national rules, financed exclusively by the federal government through the federal tax system. All very different from Medicaid. Another big difference between Medicare and Medicaid is that Medicaid actually has a very generous benefit package. Even in all 50 states, even with the debates we've been talking about whether to cover dentistry or mental health or podiatry or whatever, Medicaid has a generous benefit package. Medicare historically has not had a generous benefit package. Medicare has had a limited benefit package. In fact, remember when Medicare was enacted in 1965, what was enacted was a hospital insurance program and a physician's insurance program. And that's pretty much what Medicare historically has covered. It doesn't cover a whole bunch of preventive care. It doesn't cover vision. It doesn't cover long-term care. It doesn't cover, until a month ago, prescription drugs outside of a hospital, other than a few drugs that were covered also in physicians' offices, mainly oncologists' office, chemo of various sorts. So it has a limited benefit package. Now, because Medicare has such a limited benefit package, most of the elderly and most Medicare beneficiaries try to get some form of supplemental insurance to fill in the gaps between what Medicare covers for them and what they need. So who fills in the gaps? What are some of the sources of coverage? AARP. So AARP is an example of what's known as a Medigap policy. There are some private insurance companies that sell insurance products to fill in the gap between what you need and what Medicare offers. Yeah? Other folks fill in the gap through the veteran system. Other folks, in fact, the largest number, I suppose, and these numbers are all in your some of the readings that you have. I mean, there's the largest number have coverage from their former employer, you know, some sort of retiree health plan. I mean, let's see, as of a couple of years ago anyway, 35% of Medicare beneficiaries had employer-sponsored health insurance to supplement their Medicare. Of those, 28% of those 35 had retiree coverage, and 7% were still working, even though they were over the age of 65 and just had, you know, regular employer-sponsored insurance. 21% had Medigap policies like AARP or some sort of Medigap policy that people just buy individually. They just pay the premiums and buy individually these private insurance policies. Another 12% enrolled in Medicare managed care plans because those managed care plans provided some of the services that Medicare, traditional Medicare, did not provide. Another 17% were duly eligible. They had Medicaid also. And so if you have Medicaid and Medicare, Medicare is the first payer, but then Medicaid fills in the gap the gaps between what you get from Medicare and what you need. So all in all, about 85% of Medicare beneficiaries have some form of supplemental coverage through those various alternatives. And about 15% of Medicare beneficiaries have no supplemental coverage. Yeah. Have what?
75.
I couldn't hear what you said.
What was the total percentage that have coverage?
85. So again, limited benefits. And again, it's, when I say limited benefits, it's not simply that they don't cover things like, you know, prescription drugs or vision or preventive care. Medicare also has very high deductibles and copays. Very high deductibles and copays. So even, for example, hospital care, which is covered, you have to pay. Let's see if I can get this number right. I'm going to give you the right number. If you go into a hospital, Medicare will pay basically 90 days per spell, but there's an $876 deductible right up front. So you pay the first $876, and then you have to pay, you know, then there's copays. So there's, you know, there's a lot of copays, a lot of deductibles, limited benefits. So people get supplemental insurance to cover all this stuff. One other sort of framing the story piece that I want to give you, which is that the financing of Medicare is very, very different between Part A and Part B. Part A of Medicare, which is the hospital coverage, is your classic social insurance program. And that's the program in which everybody is automatically eligible when they hit 65. And that's the program that, as a worker, you pay into the trust fund. So basically the way Part A is financed is everybody who works, when they're young workers, they're under the age of, you know, they're working, they pay 1.45%, the employee pays 1.45% of his or her salary into the Medicare Part A trust fund. And the employer pays 1.45% of the salary into the Part A trust fund. If you're self-employed, you have to pay the whole thing yourself. So basically, 2.9% of your income as a worker goes into this Medicare trust fund. And that Medicare fund is used to pay the bills, the hospital bills, of the Medicare beneficiaries. So the way Part A works is current workers contribute to a tax fund, contribute taxes, and that fund is used to pay hospital bills incurred by the elderly. So Part A, you pay when you're young, and you get the benefit when you're old. That's the way Part A works. That's the way Social Security works. That's a classic social insurance. Everybody pays in when they're young. Everybody gets back when they're old. Part B is very different. Part B pays for your physician care, your outpatient care, etc. Part B is a voluntary program. You don't have to pay into Part B if you don't want to. It's optional. Part A is not optional. Every worker has to pay into Part A. Part B is optional. And the way Part B works is you, when you become eligible for Medicare at the age of 65, you decide whether or not you want to also get Part B coverage, the physician's insurance coverage. And if you do, then you have to pay a monthly premium. And right now, what is the monthly premium? Right now, the monthly premium is $88.50 a month. So if you're on Medicare, you make a decision whether or not you want Part B coverage. You automatically get Part A, but you have to choose to enroll in Part B. And if you get Part B, you pay $88 a month, Right now, and for the last 40 years, everybody on Medicare has paid the same premium. Starting next year, for the first time, the premium is going to be means tested. And that means people who make over $80,000 a year will pay more, higher premiums. We'll come to that later. But you pay a premium. That premium is supposed to pay 25% of the Part B cost of the whole bill. That's how they figure out what that Part B premium is. 25% of the cost of Part B beneficiaries are supposed to pay with premium. The other 75% comes out of general revenues, general federal revenues. So again, very different financing. Part A, young workers pay into a trust fund, and the trust fund pays for beneficiary hospital care. Part B, young workers don't pay into Part B at all. Beneficiaries, when they become eligible for the program, decide whether or not they want to be in Part B. In fact, what happens is you're automatically enrolled in Part B, but then you can opt out if you want. But 95% of the folks stay in. So 95% of Medicare beneficiaries have Part B coverage, 5% opt out. And if you have it, you have to pay the premium each month. Very, very different financing schemes. Everybody understand that so far? Because this becomes very important to the debate over the future of Medicare. Okay. Now, from 1965, when Medicare was enacted, until the early 1990s, 93, 94, basically for the first 28, 29, 30 years of the program, the Part A trust fund took in a lot more money each year than it paid out in hospital bills. There were a lot of young workers. There weren't as many older beneficiaries. And because of that, the trust fund took in a lot more money than it paid out. So by 92, 93, 94, there was about $100 billion surplus in the Part A trust fund. During that period, when Part A would take in a lot more every year than it paid out, and it was building up this big surplus, during that period, Medicare was a very, very non-controversial, politically popular program. Again, remember, people feel as if they're paying in to Medicare. They're getting a benefit that they've paid for. They've earned it. It's their right. And therefore, they're happy to have it, especially if there's a situation where a lot more money than it's paying out. So there was a consensus for that first 30-year period, don't touch Medicare. There was a consensus during that first 30-year period that Medicare should remain a fee-for-service program, that Medicare should remain a program in which the federal government was the single payer. There was a consensus that Medicare beneficiaries should not be required or even significantly encouraged to enroll in managed care. There was a consensus among Republicans and among Democrats of hands-off Medicare. The elderly liked it. Young people liked it. Young people felt like it was going to be there. It was there for their mother and their grandmother. It would be there for them when they grew old. You gave in, but you got back. Popular program, seemed okay financially. Everything was hunky-dory. And whenever there was any concern, and there was occasionally concern about program costs escalating way too rapidly, because the hospitals pretty much were able to bill whatever they wanted and doctors could bill. Whenever there was concern about costs, Congress, in a consensual, bipartisan fashion, would figure out some sort of remedy. So, for example, I mentioned earlier DRGs. In the early 1980s, there was concern that hospitals were being paid too much under the Medicare program. because basically hospitals were able to bill whatever they wanted, and hospitals were billing a fortune, and they were getting paid a fortune, and Medicare costs were rising too rapidly, the theory went. Congress, in a bipartisan fashion, fundamentally changed the way they reimbursed hospitals. And they switched from a system in which hospitals got paid whatever they wanted to a system in which the federal government basically set rates for Medicare. But they did that in a consensual fashion. And actually, the federal government was pretty good at keeping Medicare costs in check. Part of the reason we built up this $100 billion surplus was Medicare used its rate-setting ability to keep reimbursement rates somewhat in check. And so the rate of increase in costs in the Medicare program from 65 to 95 was significantly lower than the rate of increase in costs in private health insurance in the United States. Medicare was an efficient program, is a pretty efficient program, low administrative costs, consensus program, and that's the way it was for the first 30 years. Mid-1990s, the politics of Medicare began to change. So what changed? Well, first of all, remember 1994, it's a pivotal year. A couple of years earlier, Bill Clinton had been elected president. The previous year, Bill Clinton had proposed national health insurance. We'll talk about that next week. That proposal had gone down to, you know, a devastating defeat. In the midterm elections, Newt Gingrich, who I just was talking about before the break, becomes the Speaker of the House. The Republicans take over Congress. They're talking about the contract with America. And basically, the Republicans are ascendant in power. Clinton's weakened significantly and on the defensive. At the same time, the mid-1990s is when the private sector, the business community, begins to adopt managed care, head over heels. Thinks managed care is going to be the total solution to the healthcare cost crisis in the United States. And we'll come back to that a little bit when we do managed care in a couple of weeks. But mid-90s, and so that's the second thing that happens. So you've got the Republicans, the conservative Republicans basically take over Congress, and you've got the business community moving to managed care. Third thing that happens is for the first time, really, in a long time, in the 30-year history of the program, the actuaries who look at the spending, who look at the income, who look at the revenue of Medicare Part A, remember, we're just talking about Part A now, the trust fund, they say, you know what? We're in trouble. Why are we in trouble? In fact, in the early 1990s, remember how I said for that, basically for that first 30-year period, the money coming into the trust fund was greater than the money going out, so you built up this $100 billion surplus. Well, early 1990s, for the first time, the money going out is greater than the money coming in any given year. And so in order to pay its bills, since the money coming in is less than the money going out, Medicare has to begin dipping into the trust fund. And so the actuaries in early 1994 say, you know what, by the time we get to 2001, by the time we get to 2002, the reserve, the surplus is going to be completely gone. That $100 billion is going to be gone. The amount of money Medicare takes in, Part A takes in each year is going to be significantly less than the amount of money it's supposed to pay out. That's why we'll go through the $100 billion surplus. And Medicare will be quote-unquote bankrupt. It won't have the money to pay the bill. So the argument goes, 1994, 1995. It won't have the money to pay the bills, at least if it's just going to be financed exclusively by that trust fund. Now remember, Medicare Part B isn't financed by a trust fund at all. It's just financed 25% by premiums and 75% by general revenues. You know, nobody was talking about a crisis in Part B. The crisis only occurs if you think of, can the trust fund pay the bills exclusively? And of course, the reason that things were changing so dramatically is that demographics were changing. The baby boomer generation was beginning to age. and there were fewer and fewer young workers and more Medicare beneficiaries, so you had fewer people paying in and more people receiving benefits. You also had the situation in which hospitals were using all sorts of new technology. They were using all sorts of new drugs. They were using all sorts of new, you know, procedures. They were using more, utilization was up. I mean, so the hospitals were also generating more bills. But there was, in 94, 95, this perception, this political perception, that there was a Medicare crisis. And so in 1995, as the presidential campaign heats up between Bill Clinton and Bob Dole, who ran for president on the Republican ticket in 1996, one of the key elements of that debate was who had the better plan to quote-unquote save Medicare from bankruptcy. Is there a question in the back there somewhere? Yeah. Well, wages were, I mean, I don't think wages were decreasing in the 90s. I mean, they were not necessarily keeping up with inflation, but I think it was more a question of keeping up with inflation. And so, yeah, so that's another reason that money, you know, money wasn't coming in quite as much. Although the economy was pretty strong in the early mid-90s. The economy was in pretty good shape. It wasn't, say, as, you know, in the early 2000s when we were in a recession, then you have fewer people at work, unemployment. It didn't really rise too much in the early 2000s, but in a recession, in theory, if unemployment increases, then you really do have fewer people paying in. Wages, again, it depends on the sector of the economy you're talking about. Also, clearly, to the extent we were moving more toward a service economy wages were lower than manufacturing economies. So that, I think, may have had something to do with it as well. All right. So you've got this political debate now over who has the better plan to save Medicare. And for the first time, Medicare becomes a partisan issue. For the previous 30 years, Medicare had always been bipartisan. Republicans, Democrats, they all supported the program. They all basically agreed, you know, we want to keep it solvent, keep it in good shape. If we have to do something, we'll do it in a bipartisan fashion. But 94, 95, the country really entered into a new era of partisanship. And Gingrich and the Republicans started to say, you know what, Medicare is a fossil. Medicare is an outlier. Medicare is the only large insurance company in the United States that is still the sort of single, you know, is run by the federal government. The federal government's inefficient. The federal government can't, you know, doesn't innovate well. The federal government has the single payer fee-for-service system. We need to bring competition. We need to bring market values. We need to privatize. We need to bring managed care into Medicare. That's what Gingrich et al. Begin to say. And so the Republicans in Congress push hard to move Medicare away from sort of a federally run, federally administered, single-payer, fee-for-service system toward more of a managed care, voucher-based, private sector program. Of course, Clinton has his own initiatives, his own proposals as to how to save Medicare, or quote-unquote save Medicare. So the debate goes on. Clinton wins the election. And in 1997, Congress passes what's known as the Balanced Budget Act. The largest piece of the Balanced Budget Act was an effort to balance the Medicare budget. So let me actually, when we start thinking about how we're going to save Medicare, quote unquote, from this big crisis that it's in, let me ask you, what are some of the options? I mean, if you're talking, I mentioned one. I sort of started us off. I mean, you know, Gingrich and et al. Were saying managed care. So one thing you could do is you could say, well, if we switch to managed care, we'll have more private competition, we'll have a more efficient system, we'll have a better system, we'll save money. What else can you do to try to, if you're worried about rising Medicare costs, what else can you do? Yeah. You can raise the age limit. So you had folks who said, you know what, 65, geez, 65 ain't what 65 used to be, you know, when Medicare was enacted in 1965. I never really put that together. It's pretty clever. But you could raise the age. So some people said, let's raise it to 68 or 70, you know, or whatever. Then Medicare will cover fewer people at a later date. You can do that. What else? Yeah. You can means test the program. You can basically say, you know what? It's not right. I mean, here the Medicare program is in fiscal distress, is in fiscal crisis. The Part A program is going quote-unquote bankrupt, and we're paying for the hospital bill of Bill Gates' mom. You know, why should we be doing that? You know, shouldn't we be installing some sort of means testing, you know, basically saying, you know, wealthy people shouldn't be eligible for Medicare? So you can try a means test program. What else can you do? Yeah. You could try to raise revenue through a variety of ways of increasing tax revenue. I mean, you can raise the cap. You can make, instead of 2.9%, you can make a 3.2%. I mean, you could basically say, let's just raise taxes. You could try to raise taxes just on wealthy people. You know, there's a variety of ways you could try to increase the revenue coming in. Remember, the revenue coming into Part A is this tax revenue. So you can raise taxes. That's a fourth option. What else can you do? Yeah. You could charge premiums. Although you can increase deductibles, copays, premiums. You know, basically increase the payments that the beneficiaries have to make. Yeah.
You're allowed to do that according to their yearly income?
Excuse me? Absolutely, and in fact, sort of connect that to sort of means testing. Yeah. You could sort of try to emphasize disease management and prevention. Again, it's not totally dissimilar from the Medicaid list. Yeah. You could say, although by this point the question was the surplus was going to be gone, but you could basically try to privatize some of the surplus and get a better rate of return. Basically, what the federal government does with the surplus right now is it invests it in United States bonds, and it gets 6.2% interest. So that's what the feds get right now. They get 6.2% interest. You could say instead of getting 6.2% interest on these bonds, they should get, if they invested in the market, they can get 10, 15, 20% interest. Of course, you could lose too, but at least you could, in theory, you can get more. Yeah. So you could sort of try to go to the markets. Let me just give you one or two other things you can do. You could cut reimbursement. Yeah, you can cut reimbursement. Or you can get it fraud and abuse, as we talked about earlier. All right, so those options were all on the table in the 95-96 era. So Clinton wins re-election, and he goes to Congress, and basically Congress passes the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. And the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 picks three of these. Balanced Budget Act says we want to encourage more managed care in the program. The Balanced Budget Act says we want to cut reimbursement. And the Balanced Budget Act says we want to cut fraud and abuse. Those are the three levers, the three tools that Congress picks in 1997 to deal with the Medicare cost crisis. So we're going to do more managed care, we're going to have less fraud and abuse, you know, we're going to encourage people to join managed care plans, we're going to hire more investigators and lawyers and cops to basically root out more fraud and abuse in the system, and we're going to just straight out cut what we pay to hospitals, cut what we pay to nursing homes, cut what we pay to home care agencies. Well, basically, the managed care initiative didn't really play out as planned. Ironically, and we'll get into this when we talk about managed care in a couple of weeks, ironically, managed care enrollment in the late 1990s and early 2000s declined in Medicare. It didn't increase. And there's a lot of reasons for that, which I don't want to spend a lot of time on now because we'll come to it later. But the bottom line is managed care enrollment declined. It didn't increase. So the effort to sort of save Medicare by pushing more managed care didn't work. I mean, that didn't work, at least in 1997, 1998, 1999. The effort to reduce fraud and abuse, well, that sort of worked. I mean, they hired more investigators. They did more audits. You know, they cut back. You know, they collected some money from some big hospitals that overcharged. They scared some docs. So actually, the fraud and abuse piece was okay. But the big elephant in the room, as I say, were the reimbursement cuts. Congress, in the 1997 Balanced Budget Act, imposed draconian, serious, significant, deep cuts on hospitals, on nursing homes, and on home care agencies. Medicare reimbursement to those three groups of providers plunged following the 1997 Act. Basically, Medicare, because it sets the rates, the federal government, if they decided they were just going to pay less money, they could pay less money. And lo and behold, if the goal was to reduce and to sort of shift the immediate crisis and end the immediate crisis, it was completely successful. All of a sudden, instead of Medicare taking in less than it was paying out, all of a sudden, Medicare started taking in much more again than it was paying out. The immediate crisis ended. It ended. Of course, the hospitals and the nursing homes and the home care agencies basically have said, you solved your problem by forcing us into near bankruptcy. You know, because you're not paying us near what we need. We're in, you know, so you're cutting our reimbursement. You know, managed care plans are cutting our reimbursement. Medicaid's cutting our reimbursement. You know, we're in big trouble. We're asked to be doing more with less. A number of home care agencies went out of business. A number of for-profit nursing homes went out of business. Hospitals started pleading poverty. But if the goal was to cut Medicare spending, it worked. In fact, in 1999, not only did Medicare hospital reimbursement not increase significantly, the amount of money that Medicare paid hospitals actually declined. You know, and that's almost unheard of for an insurance program to pay less than it did 2 years previously. So all of a sudden, in the late 90s and early 2000s, the dynamic changed. The surplus started going up again instead of going down. And so, for example, right now, let me see if I have this number. In 2004, so it's a number, this number is a little bit off, but in 2004, the surplus in the Medicare Part A Trust Fund was at $269 billion. So Medicare had, as of 2004, in the Part A Trust Fund, $269 billion more than it needed. And so it was investing that money in bonds and sort of, and basically the federal government uses that money to help reduce the budget deficit, you know, but it sort of, you know, they pay some interest on it, etc. Almost overnight, as a result of the Balanced Budget Act, the politics of Medicare changed extraordinarily. Remember, in 1995 and in 1996, the politics of Medicare were who has the better plan to save Medicare from bankruptcy. In 1998 and 1999 and 2000, as a result of the Balanced Budget Act, the politics of Medicare became, what should we do with this growing surplus? And again, you have to remember in 99 and 2000, not only was the Medicare surplus getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but even though it's hard to remember today in 2006, the federal government, even outside of Medicare, had a surplus. So the government seemed to be, states had surpluses. Everybody had surpluses. We were swimming in money. The economy was strong. The BBA had seemingly saved Medicare. And so almost overnight, the debate changed from how do we save Medicare to what do we do with the surplus? And so what were the options that now were on the table? Excuse me? So the hospital said, well, geez, and the nursing home said, well, geez, you know, you save Medicare on our backs. Now you have this big surplus. You know, give us some of the money back. We're dying here. You know, we're in trouble. You know, the cuts were more draconian than you really expected. Give us some of the money back. So that's what the hospitals and the nursing homes and the home care agencies and the docs, they all started saying, give us some reimbursement increases. You know, give some of the surplus to us. What else? Yeah. Then you had folks who said, you know what? We may be taking in more money right now, and the surplus may be up to $269 billion in 2004. But you know what? Demographics are demographics, and unless we significantly change the tax base, if we keep the same tax base, if we look at the demographics, if we look at the fact that we're going to have fewer workers per elderly folk, you know, down the line, the actuaries today, remember the actuaries in 1994-95 were saying that Medicare, the reserves were going to run out in 2001-2002. Well, now they're saying the reserves are going to run out in about 2020. So today, you know, even though we have a $269 billion surplus, the actuaries are saying if we just keep on the same course, that money is going to be gone. That $269 billion is going to be gone in 14-15 years. Now, of course, that's what they, you know, who knows? These estimates, you know, who knows what's going to happen? And, of course, you can always change the estimates by cutting reimbursement or by increasing taxes or whatever. But some people said, you know, instead of spending this money, let's put it in sort of the phrase of the day became, let's put it in a lockbox. Almost like, you know, let's you know, go to grandma's house and get a safety deposit box and, you know, deposit the money there so that we can get interest on it or that we don't get interest on it or that we put it in a... The stock market would actually be too risky for something like that. But just let's earmark it all separately in a rainy day fund and let's not spend it. That's another option. What's another option? Yeah.
Tax cuts for the wealthy?
Well, there's certainly tax cuts. I'm not sure any... I think what most politicians would say is let's cut taxes at least for... you know, the you know, the middle class. I mean, they're not going to say tax cuts for the wealthy, but some cynical public health student might say that. But absolutely, you could say tax cuts. You know, in effect, we now are drawing in all this extra money. We were doing tax cuts big time in 99 and 2000. You know, the Bush administration was doing big income tax cuts primarily for the wealthy, or at least the impact was primarily for the wealthy. States were cutting taxes, sales tax, income tax, and the like. So why not cut the Social Security tax? Instead of taking in 2.9%, let's cut it back to 2.8 or 2.7, etc. So you can cut taxes. What else can you do? Come on, what's the big elephant in the room right now? Excuse me? You can expand services, and what service do you think was at the top of the list? Prescription drugs. So you can increase reimbursement and keep it all on a rainy day fund. You can cut taxes. You can increase benefits. You can reduce copays. You can reduce deductibles. You can add a variety of services. Any other ideas? How about lowering the eligibility age? Some people said, let's use Medicare, in effect, to help the uninsured. Big program, inexpensive program, at least by insurance standards, low administrative fees. Let's lower, 5 years earlier, we were talking about raising the age to 68, 70. Late 90s, some people say, let's lower the age, to 63 or to 60 or whatever, to reduce the number of people who are uninsured. Because there's a large number of people in that 55 to 65 block who are uninsured, because they work and then they lose their job when they're 55, 56, and they have trouble finding another job, and they don't have health insurance. So all these ideas were on the table in the late 90s. And again, it's a pretty interesting and pretty amazing political story as to how we move from how we are going to save. I don't know what this says about American politics, but it's a pretty interesting story in moving how we're going to cut the program to save Medicare to what are we going to do with the big surplus that we now have. But that's how the dynamic began to change. So enter into the mix a presidential campaign. Bill Clinton's finishing up his second term. Al Gore is running for president to replace, take over. George Bush wins the Republican nomination. So you've got Bush against Gore. Early on in that presidential campaign, Bush is significantly ahead in the polls. And then Gore begins talking about two healthcare ideas. One of them is prescription drugs for the elderly. And the other, actually, which is not relevant to this discussion tonight, the other is sort of a managed care bill of rights, which we'll talk about, given the backlash against managed care. So Gore begins talking about health care. He begins talking about prescription drugs. And Gore basically says, we've got this surplus. The federal government has this surplus. The states have a surplus. Medicare has a surplus. It's not right, it's not fair that Medicare doesn't cover prescription drugs. Let's expand Medicare to create a new Part D. Just to sort of fill in what C was. A was hospital, B was physician. They were in 1965. The Balanced Budget Act in 1997 created Part C of Medicare, which is really the managed care part. That sort of allows HMOs to participate in Medicare. That was Part C. That is Part C. So Gore says, let's have a Part D, which will cover prescription drugs for all Medicare beneficiaries. George Bush says, you know what? Says Bush. Never mind. No, he says, look, most Medicare beneficiaries, says Bush, have some Medicare prescription drug coverage right now. They either have it from their retiree health plan, or they have it from a managed care plan, or they have it from Medicaid, or they buy it from a Medigap policy, where they have it from some state pharmaceutical assistance program. So George Bush says, most Medicare beneficiaries have drug coverage of some form already. What we ought to do, says Bush, is provide coverage for those Medicare beneficiaries who don't have any coverage right now, any drug coverage right now, rather than giving drug coverage to all 42 million Medicare beneficiaries, says Bush, let's focus in on the 10 or 11 million that don't have any drug coverage. Why should the federal government, says Bush, you know, spend Medicare federal dollars, you know, in place of private Medigap dollars or retiree health dollars or etc.? Let's fill in the gap. Let's provide a welfare medicine in approach effect. And so what Bush proposes during the campaign is that the federal government give $48 billion to the states for the states to use to provide prescription drug coverage for Medicare beneficiaries who didn't have access to another form of drug coverage. The goal that Bush was pushing at that point was he liked very much the idea of means testing Medicare. And this would be a first step, basically saying Medicare will pay for drug benefits only for those who can't afford it themselves and don't have access to it themselves. And we're going to do it through the states. So we're going to means test the program, and we're going to run it through the states. Yeah.
Through a block grant?
Through a block grant. Each state will get a block grant to use to provide to create a pharmaceutical assistance program on behalf of low-income seniors in their state to provide pharmaceutical assistance to them. So there were actually these kind of, you know, bizarre moments during the debates between Bush and Gore in the campaign in 2000, in which they were talking about their prescription drug plans, and they were just completely talking over each other, and it wasn't at all clear, I think, to most of the American public what either of them was proposing. I mean, Gore was proposing basically that Medicare essentially pay 50% of the drug bills of all Medicare beneficiaries. And Bush was proposing that dollars be given to the states for pharmaceutical assistance programs for low-income seniors. Fundamentally different philosophical approaches. Both, though, able to argue clearly and consistently that they had a plan for drug assistance for low-income elderly, well, for the elderly, either the low-income elderly or all of the elderly. So to the extent that Gore was or had been scoring some significant political points with the elderly who were a popular group and who were voted a lot and who, you know, seemed to be, it seemed to be unfair that they didn't have access to drugs, to the extent Gore was scoring some points on that, Bush is able to neutralize that by saying that he too has a prescription drug plan. Even though, of course, it's a fundamentally different kind of prescription drug plan, you know, with a fundamentally different philosophical approach, you know, whichever, you know, rightly or wrongly. I mean, just two very different approaches as to how you should handle it. I think what I want to do is I'm going to stop here because, again, next week what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the uninsured. Then in 2 weeks when we come back, when we come back after the President's Day break, I'm going to pick up the story around prescription drugs with Bush becomes president and what happens, you know, how did we end up with the prescription drug law that we have now. Try to spend a little bit of time, you know, every day in the New York Times, every day in the Wall Street Journal, about every day on CBS News or ABC, there's something about the new prescription drug bill and some of the implementation issues and some of the problems. Try to read up a little bit about it and learn a little bit about it on your own. And then we'll come and talk about that bill, and we'll come and talk about what it says, and we'll come and talk about how it's been implemented in a couple of weeks. Thanks.